This is Dodo, poodle.
This is Montez Press Radio. Next up, we have Tongue in Cheek. It's our show of live exercises, interviews, and archival sound. These guys are looking at how we voice, how we breathe, how we gesture, how we empathize, how we manner, how our bodies are moved by communication. Timmy, artist and professor, is going to introduce the rest of the gang. Take it away, Timmy.
Tongue in Cheek is back here. Actually, I'm going to pass it to Emma to introduce the rest of the gang. Tom, thanks for introducing me.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Tongue in Cheek. We're thrilled to be back on air. It's Aaron Lehman, myself, Emma McCormick Goodhart, and Timothy Simmons.
So today, I mean, do we want to start off by actually telling us where we're going? Or are we just going to start off with some sound?
I think some sound.
Some sound.
So we wanted to spend this show talking about canon, like the idea of canon music, how to define that, and then also how that can play out in the what's considered a more tangible way in the real world, because I guess in music it's always considered totally in the abstract. So we want to start out with with some definitions, the different ways canon is defined. So in music, a canon is a counterpoint-based compositional technique, and it employs a melody with one or more imitations of the melody played after a given duration, so like a quarter rest or a measure. In a more general definition, it is a general law, rule, principle, or criterion by which something is judged. And my personal favorite definition is in the Roman Catholic Church in that context. It's the part of the Mass containing the words of consecration. So we're going to play a canon by Meredith Monk called Return to Earth.
No.
So just to reiterate those definitions, in music, the canon is counterpoint-based compositional technique that employs a melody with one or more imitations of the melody played after a given duration. So in that, you might have been able to hear that there were repeating elements that certain parts of the group sings, and then other parts of the group repeat those elements or imitations of those elements at a staggered interval, so that they overlap and create this dynamic whole.
And in this particular canon, the interval actually changes. That's what I think is really fascinating about this canon, is that as a part of the instruction of how it's composed, somebody's holding up two fingers, one finger, or five fingers, which actually triggers each group of the canon to repeat the nea nea, either nea nea, nea nea, nea nea, nea, five times, or one time, or two times. And so that essentially offsets the structure of the repeating, imitating form throughout. So I think that's not necessarily particular to that canon. I think it's sort of a larger logic. It's almost like a social logic in some ways, right? It's like defining a body from the inside out, or a social body from the inside out. And sort of actually listening to that also makes me sort of think about the way of a kind of social reverberation and social coordination of a canon as equivalent to, you know, trying to find, well, what is that equivalent to in our body? Is it the glottis? Is it the vibration of the vocal cords? Chords, plural.
Or even on a more social level, just a set of rules that provide a coordination, not through providing content with meaning, but it provides, you know, just the coordination, that it's mm-hmm. just a set of rules that, like in a canon, how it defines when different elements are supposed to enter and repeat on a social level, just, you know, linguistically, how it just coordinating people's bodies in mm-hmm. behavior without there being much meaning to what those repeating or coordinated elements are, and then mm-hmm. they can change over time, mm-hmm. that it provides a structure.
A true socialese, right?
Yes. So we're going to play two activations of canon.
Do we want to do the exercise of one first, or do we want to do that first? Okay.
Let's do the exercise first.
Thanks, Amy. So this is just maybe to keep hold of a further definition of canon. So we're just coming up with our own verses of a phrase, breaking a phrase into verses. The full phrase is, well, let's go verse by verse. I'd say, first verse, second verse, do you say? Third verse, I do. Last verse, I'd say. So I'd say is the beginning and the end. So again, that's I'd say, do you say, I do, I'd say. And so as with a canon, there's an interval or a sort of offset almost in the way that they overlap each other. And that's going to happen. So the second voice, as it were, the other part of this coordinating body is going to start at I do. So that's the third line in. I'd say, do you say,
I do. Say, right. Do you say.
Right. I'd say.
Yeah. So why don't we try that just to
demonstrate. So if you Aaron did it here, but maybe if you're on the other end, if you want to write it down.
Yeah, absolutely. If somebody's listening and you want to participate, write down this phrase and try to following that rule. So again, the phrase is I'd say, do you say, I do. I'd say, and it helps to have it written down.
I'd say. We all scream for ice cream.
Yeah.
Okay, we're gonna do it between the three of us, and then we'll put a gap in and try to count it so that we can have your voice as a part too. Yeah. You as in on the other end.
I'd say, do you say, I do. I'd say. I'd say, do you say.
I'd say, do you say, I'd say, do you say,
I do, I'd say.
I messed it up.
Let's start again, and let's maybe let it go around twice.
A canon always has the capacity to correct itself, so let's not.
There's no script. Okay.
You want to do it, Tim?
To start? I think you're keeping beautiful time.
So I'd say.
Should I go second? I'd say. I'll go second. Kay. Let's say.
I'd say. Do you say?
I'd say. Do you say? I do.
I'd say.
I'd say. Do you say? I do.
I'd say.
I'd say. I'd say. Do you say? I do. I'd say. I'd say. Do you say? I do.
I'd say.
I'd say. Do you say?
I do.
I'd say. I'd say. Do you say? I do.
I'd say. I do. I'd say. I'd say. Do you say?
I do. I'd say. I'd say. do you say? I do.
I do.
I'd say.
I'd say.
I'd say.
So, I mean, it's interesting because you have to kind of listen to the other person for a cue to know when you're going to do it. But at that point, you have to solely focus on what you're saying, or else it's impossible. If you actually listen to the whole of it, you're gonna mess it up. You're gonna fall out of step. You sort of have to focus on your part solely, and while also focusing on in the most basic way on when your cue is.
Right. I mean, it's sort of gearing a lot of the material that we're gonna go over today. This sort of mix between. It is a continuous mix between sort of listening and ignoring and listening and trusting.
It's fun to begin to operate in the break, to begin to riff with each other, and to turn a fugue into a jazz,
yes,
improvisation.
Should we go through it one more time, and then we'll play these two examples of canons?
Yeah, let's do it at a different tempo.
Okay.
Okay.
Can you guide us?
Okay.
Yeah.
I'd say. Do you say?
I do. I'd say. I'd say. Do you say?
I do.
I'd say. I'd say. Do you say?
I do.
I'd say.
I'd say.
Do you say?
I do.
I'd say.
I'd say.
Do you say?
I do.
I'd say.
I'd say.
Do you say?
I do.
I'd say.
I'd say.
I do say.
I do.
I
say. Do you say?
I do.
Oh, we never started. We were just. I couldn't get in there.
Join in.
I couldn't get in.
Join in.
Should we try? Can we try again? We can keep the same. Maybe don't speed up though. Just keep it fast.
Okay.
Are you going second, Aaron?
Yeah. Okay. I'll do that.
1, 2, 3, 4. I'd say. Do you say?
I do.
I'd say.
I'd say.
Do you say?
I
do. I'd say. I'd say. Do you say? I do. I'd say.
Impossible.
it gets to something else that is, I think, really interesting about canon, which is that you want to empathize with maybe a voice that you hear around you, and so you want to repeat what they're saying, what they're about to say.
We want to be in step with each other.
Right.
Yeah.
This is a natural.
But we have to be one step off, at least. One more time. Maybe we can do it a little bit slower first.
Okay. I'd say, do you say,
I I'd do. Say, do you
I'd say,
say, I'd say, do you say,
I
do,
I'd say,
I'd say, do you say,
I do,
I'd say,
I'd say,
do you say,
I do,
I'd say,
I'd say,
do you say,
I do,
I'd say,
I'd say,
do you say,
I do,
I'd say,
I do,
I'd say, I do, I'd say.
Beautiful.
All right.
So now we play two canons. One is a piece, the first is a piece that I staged at Oxford University's examination schools with three professors I was conducting. They were speaking, well, I shouldn't introduce it.
No, perhaps. It's great because we're playing two different pieces. The first is Emma's. That she conducted. Mine was also, and the second is mine, which I'll maybe just introduce very briefly now, because in comparison, it also used a bunch of faculty members from a variety of schools that taught English composition to in programs that weren't focused around English composition, and they were reading a book or a part of a book of a book of my own in canon. So these are sort of just two examples of canons that Emma has produced and one that I produced also.
So in my case, they were each reading a paper that they'd written. And this is played in the memory of Katharina Reed Tosha, who has since passed away, but an amazing Greek art historian.
These conditions are in. We've now started to rely on
the same,
is going to be here as a witness tonight is 2020.
The idea of a super
that you create a system behind your range of
Two's a paradox, but three's perspective.
And this coming one is called Faculty Canon. Like I said before, it also involves, which I think is really interesting that these two pieces that we're showing, or that we're playing, involve people that are in teaching positions, which I think is, I mean, to me personally, is has something of like this sort of centrifugal force, this but something to do both with privacy and a publicness that is never necessarily seen. So it's, for me, sort of interesting to think of, like, well, why does, what's the instinct of putting that kind of voice, that kind of person in a canon?
It also plays with the other meaning of canon, which is the classics, or that which has been canonized, made
established
canonical.
As like a rule.
And so here is Faculty Canon, an excerpt.
So, in classical composition, you would typically master a canon and progress to compose a fugue, and that would be your sort of magnum opus as a composer. And so a fugue is an extension of how a canon functions in music. Its definition is it is also a counterpoint-based composition in which a short melody or phrase is introduced by one part and successively taken up by others and developed by interweaving the parts. So it creates a much more complex and dynamic interplay between many components. Another context for fugue is in psychiatry. And in psychiatry, it's defined as a state or period of loss of awareness of one's identity, often coupled with flight from one's usual environment. So we're going to play one of Bach's fugues. And Bach is well known as probably one of the first to master this sort of polyphonic music with many different voices. Thank you.
Counterpoint assumes a love between the parts. Jonathan Burrows.
So now we're going to go back to the beginning of this fugue and just tell you sort of so you get like a kind of graphic feeling for it when these other parts are coming in, just very simply, just so you can hear it. So that's the first. And here comes the second now. Third's coming. And now. Another one came in. I missed it.
So for me personally, what seems to be the most relevant takeaway from all these different definitions is the implication of there being a rule. In canon, there's the rule of repetition. In the fugue, there is maybe not as much of a rule as much of a structure. And that the takeaway for me in all these definitions is that there is a definition of a relationship, and then the parts that are defined are often interchangeable. And I think we're all interested in how the relationships that are defined in canon and fugue could function in other ways, not just in music, but in the real world, and how, you know, maybe music can be an interesting exploration of those relationships.
How do you see that in relationship to the other definition of fugue?
So the other definition of fugue is the psychiatric one, which is, hold on 1 second, let me pull that. So it's a state or period of loss of awareness of one's identity, often coupled with flight from one's usual environment. So what distinguishes a fugue from a canon is that it's not just a set repetition of voices that are repeat in staggered intervals, but there are many voices, and they sort of they interweave and create this more comprehensive, complex whole, you know, losing their sort of distinctiveness. They fall in and out, depending on how many voices are present in Bach's. When three voices becomes four, one of the other voices typically simplifies and becomes long stretches of single notes. So there's this sort of constant, what's the word I'm looking for?
Inter-articulatedness?
Well, yeah, they sort of vary between like articulating themselves and being at the forefront to subordinating to other voices, mm-hmm. and losing their distinctive identities.
It's, I mean, maybe to use a phrase that we were using the other day, it's this kind of selfless coordination of selfish things.
Yeah, so like with the canon, like when we were doing our exercise with the I'd say, do you say, there's this constant interplay between what are we personally saying and then how do we arrange that vis-a-vis what everyone else is saying. So there's this sort of like one ear constantly on what other people are saying. And yet if you fully subordinate, you know, yourself to what the group is saying, you're going to lose step.
And you have to trust that the group is going to go on.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. So, I mean, so rather than these rules, canon and fugue existing to define what exactly is repeated merely defining the relationship between these elements, and then these elements, you know, be they voice or instrumentation or melody, can vary. And so I think about this a lot in terms of tennis. I've been playing a lot of tennis recently, and tennis, by all descriptions, could sound like an incredibly deterministic and repetitive exercise, that you're just two people hitting it back and forth. But within the parameters of that relationship, there's so much dynamism, and there's so much room for excitement, and that arises from sort of two different voices. And I think about this very linguistically. I think there are a lot of parallels between tennis and language. Two different voices together forming this more dynamic whole, just like one of Bach's fugues.
But are they ever speaking at the same time?
No, I mean, rarely.
So I think it's an interesting point, because you're like picking on a very particular part of the identity of a canon, right?
Yes, the structural side of it. So in Bach's fugue, the rules are, in a lot of Bach's canons and fugues, they seem very regular, and yet they're very freeform. The voices interweave, and they seem to take on more or less complexity depending on how many other voices are present. So there's this loss of identity.
And then there's obvious in tennis, singles, doubles, quartets.
So there's this kind of convergence between the musical and psychiatric definition there. I mean, many voices or forces lose their individual distinctiveness, and they find new identity through being lost and interwoven in other voices. So one of the contemporary masters of Bach was, of course, Glenn Gould, who expanded on the already amazing complexity of Bach's polyphonic music. And his actual compositions were themselves very complex and brilliant, but he was also well known for humming when he played, because he, according to him, he couldn't actually satisfactorily play the number of voices he wanted in the music. So he would hum over the music, and apparently he was just a nightmare for sound engineers, because there's just this sort of ghostly humming of Glenn Gould in the background in all the recordings. So we're going to play one piece where you can hear his humming, and at one point he actually gets up, just walks to the window, hums for a while, and then goes back to the piano, and you'll hear that.
Thank you.
So, as a compliment to that, we're going to play now a recording of a man playing klezmer music to dolphins. And the dolphins, I don't know if they like the music, but they are very keen on participating with him.
This is fitting because Glenn Gould always wanted to compose an opera for animals. Canon as triangulated echo, chasse. We follow ourselves forward and back in canon. Our walks are in canon, in continual disalignment. To step once is to step twice, our first step. Marcel Mauss, in Techniques of the Body, writes, "A kind of revelation came to me in hospital. I was ill in New York. I wondered where previously I had seen girls walking as my nurses walked. I had the time to think about it. At last I realized that it was at the cinema. Returning to France, I noticed how common this gait was, especially in Paris. The girls were French, and they too were walking in this way. In fact, American walking fashions had begun to arrive over here, thanks to the cinema. Is dubbing in film and silent film a kind of canon, overwritten, out of time? Who leads, mouth in motion or stuck on sound? Talkies are chimeric. Simone Forti's Sleepwalkers, a canon of animals, including seaweed. Evolution, a canon of forms that rewrite themselves in canon. Biosemiotics really means tuning, attuning, attending to, rhythm analysis. Can we be in step with the sea if we put on our sea legs? The sea, waves, tuning the spatiality of the sea. Sensation, which comes to us in waves, in canon, incantatory, it incites itself, anticipatory, thinking aloud, as, in, always, in canon."
I'm just gonna add something in there that a friend just reminded me of. "I am not entitled to what I have, therefore everything I have is stolen, because I am not entitled to it, because I've stolen it. Therefore, I am not entitled to what I have, therefore everything I have is stolen, because I am not entitled to it, because I have stolen it, therefore I am not entitled to what I have." That's R.D. Lang in his book Knots.
Tim, do you want to introduce the
next,
what we're about to play?
Which is actually kind of related in a funny way to R.D. Lang. He's going to sort of introduce himself. This is Carl Rogers, who's known for person-centered therapy, or as a term he didn't like, Rogerian therapy, or what became Rogerian rhetorical arguments. A more clear way to think about it maybe is in parroting in a therapy session, or in trying to create an emphatic relationship with your patient, never giving them the answers to something, but more repeating and rephrasing the problem that they have posed themselves. So this is from a documentary of some kind done in, what is it, 1965, where a program actually went into the, well, they asked three different therapists to conduct a session on the same patient, Gloria, she is, and each of them have their own way of going about it, which are vastly different. Like the Fritz Perl one starts with them just both smoking cigarettes together.
Of course.
So you kind of you see the posture and the way that the two interface in very different ways, as in the patient and the therapist. So this is he's just gonna sort of explain a little bit his position and what he's thinking about before he goes into this session with this person Gloria, who he's never met before. And then it'll play a little bit beyond that. We'll see what we have time for.
If I can create the proper climate, the proper relationship, the proper conditions, a process of therapeutic movement will almost inevitably occur in my client. Men ask, what is this climate? What are these conditions? Will they exist in the interview with the woman I'm about to talk with, whom I've never seen before? Well, let me try to describe very briefly what these conditions are as I see them. First of all, one question is, can I be real in the relationship? This has come to have an increasing amount of importance to me over the years. I feel that genuineness is another way of describing the quality I would like to have. I like the term congruence, by which I mean that what I'm experiencing inside is present in my awareness and comes out through my communication. In a sense, when I have this quality, I'm all in one piece in the relationship. There's another word that describes it for me. I feel that in the relationship, I would like to have a transparency. I would be quite willing for my client to see all the way through me, that there would be nothing hidden. And when I'm real in this fashion that I'm trying to describe, then I know that my own feelings will often bubble up into awareness and be expressed, but be expressed in ways that won't impose themselves on my client. Then the second question I would have is, will I find myself praising this person, caring for this person? I certainly don't want to pretend a caring that I don't feel. In fact, if I dislike my client persistently, I feel it's better that I should express it. But I know that the process of therapy is much more likely to occur, and constructive change is much more likely, if I feel a real spontaneous prizing of this individual with whom I'm working, a prizing of this person as a separate individual. You can call that quality acceptance, you can call it caring, you can call it a non-possessive love, if you wish. I think any of those terms tend to describe it. I know that the relationship will prove more constructive if it's present. Then the third quality, will I be able to understand the inner world of this individual from the inside? Can I...
extra money, I like to work nights. The minute I think I'm not being real good to the children or giving them enough time, then I start feeling guilty again. Then that's when a double bind. That's just what it feels like. Mm-hmm. I want to do this and it feels right, but after all, I'm not being a good mother and I want to be both. Mm-hmm. I'm becoming more and more aware of what a perfectionist I am. That's what it seems like. I want to be so perfect. Either I want to become perfect in my standards or not have that need anymore.
Or I guess I hear it a little differently, that what you want is to seem perfect. That it means it's a great matter of great importance to you to be a good mother, and you want to seem to be a good mother even if some of your actual feelings differ from that. Does that catch you?
Yeah, I don't feel like I'm saying that. No, that isn't what I feel, really. Okay. I want to approve of me always, but my actions won't let me. I want to approve of me. I think...
I realize you... All right, but let me... Because I'd like to understand that. You sound as though your actions are kind of outside of you. You want to approve of you, but what you do somehow won't let you approve of yourself.
Right. like I feel that I can approve of myself regarding, for example, my sex life. This mm-hmm. is the big thing. If I really fell in love with a man and I respected him and I adored him, I don't think I'd feel so guilty mm-hmm. going to bed with him, and I don't think I'd have to make up any excuses to the children because they could see my natural caring for him. Mm-hmm. Okay. But when I have the physical desire and I'll say, oh, well, why not, and I want to anyway, then I feel guilty afterwards. I hate facing the kids, I don't like looking at myself, and I rarely enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And this is what I mean. If the circumstances would be different, I don't think I'd feel so guilty because I feel right about it.
And again to R.D. Lang, I don't feel good, therefore I am bad, therefore no one loves me. I feel good, therefore I am good, therefore everyone loves me. I am good, you do not love me, therefore you are bad, so I do not love you. I am good, you love me, therefore you are good, so I love you. I am bad, you love me, therefore you are bad.
Como você está? Como você está? Estou bem. Estou
bem.
Estou bem.
Estou bem.
Obrigado.
Obrigado.
Obrigado. De nada.
De nada.
De nada.
De nada.
E você?
E você?
Prazer em conhecê-lo. Prazer em conhecê-lo.
Prazer em conhecê-lo. Prazer em conhecê-lo.
Qual é seu nome?
Qual é seu nome?
Nome.
Nome.
Meu nome é...
Meu nome é...
Nome é...
Meu nome é...
Bom dia.
Bom dia.
Bom dia.
Dia.
Boa tarde.
Boa tarde.
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 Boa noite.
Boa noite. Noite.
Noite.
Noite.
Noite.
Até breve.
Até breve.
Até breve. Até logo.
Até logo.
Logo. Até amanhã.
Até amanhã.
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 Adeus.
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 Saudades.
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 Eu também.
Eu também.
Também. O que você está fazendo?
O que você está fazendo?
Fazendo. Nada.
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 Sim.
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 Não.
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 Você está ocupado?
Você está ocupado?
Ocupado. Sim, estou ocupado.
Sim, estou ocupado.
Ocupado. Você está livre?
Você está livre?
Livre. Sim, estou livre.
Sim, estou livre.
Livre. Estou com fome.
Estou com fome.
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 Estou com sede.
Estou com sede.
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 Vamos comer.
Vamos comer.
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 Comer. It's very Dutch.
Onde você mora?
Onde você mora?
Você mora.
Mora.
Eu moro em...
Eu moro em...
M. O que você está estudando? O que você está estudando?
Estudando?
Como está sua família?
Como está sua família?
Sua família? Muito bom.
Muito bom.
Muito bom. Muito mal.
Muito mal.
Muito mal. Quer comer? Quiero comer. Qua è il suo numero?
Picchio, ma apri barbarina, paurosa fuor dell'uso. Io, dal muso insospettita, guardo, cerco in ogni sito. E alzando, pian pianino, il tappeto al tavolino. Fido il paggio. Ah, cosa faccio?